Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
We don't criticize journalism as much as we need to in Canada. But we also don't celebrate journalism and journalists as much as we should in this country, even when other countries do. Canadian journalist Connie Walker recently won a Pulitzer and a Peabody. These are perhaps the two highest awards that exist in America for journalism. And barely a peep was made about that up here. Some of you might not even know who she is, which is a problem because Connie Walker is in mid-stride of a brilliant career that, frankly, everybody should know about. Much of that career was spent at the CBC, where she went from hosting Street Sense to founding CBC Aboriginal, now known as CBC Indigenous. She worked for years there as a reporter, fighting to tell Indigenous stories for many years, during which the explicit positions of her bosses was that nobody wanted to hear them. And then she proved them all miserably wrong with her breakout podcast, Missing and Murdered. In a country where the former prime minister did not believe that one inquiry was required to examine over 1,000 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, Connie Walker dedicated a long-form investigation to just one single case. And in doing so, she separated one human life, the life of Alberta Williams, from a pile of statistics, and deemed this life and its violent conclusion worthy of sustained, methodical journalistic inquiry. This was a radically humanizing application of journalism. And this was the first investigative true crime podcast the CBC ever produced, and millions of people downloaded it. And that's just one of the firsts that Connie Walker has given our burgeoning podcast industry. For example, her Pulitzer Prize is the first Pulitzer Prize ever awarded to a podcast. But here's the thing. That award was not given to Connie Walker for her work at the CBC, because for some inexplicable, head-scratching, jaw-dropping reason, CBC lost Connie Walker, and the American podcast company Gimlet quickly scooped her up. And it was for Gimlet that she produced her most personal investigation to date. Stolen, Surviving St. Michael's, an investigation not just into that residential school, but into the residential school priest who abused Connie Walker's own father. I was very pleased to welcome Connie Walker into our studio recently in Toronto to talk with her about her brilliant career so far. And maybe it's obvious, but a warning to listeners that our conversation will touch on residential school abuse, sexual and violent abuse of children. So please listen with care. Wait for it. I think that the only way to start is with like a hearty congratulations. Like, you are in the midst of like one of the all-time runs.
Really?
Like, you're four series in, like, by any measure, triumph after triumph.
Oh, thank you.
I do this often, but like, I think, you know, there's different ways people can parse this and be like, oh, Canadian journalist wins a Pulitzer or Indigenous journalist wins a Pulitzer. I just think, like, for the medium, are you the first podcaster to win a Pulitzer?
No, they've had an audio reporting
category. I know, but it was radio shows before. Like, This American Life is, like, podcast first.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure about that, honestly. I think that we were, like, the one thing I do remember is that we were the first podcast to win a Pulitzer and a Peabody in the same year.
Yes. Those are the two big ones. I think you might be the first podcaster, which is like covering our medium in glory.
I feel like having been a Canadian journalist for 20 years, I never thought about the Pulitzers, really. Like,
yeah.
I didn't actually feel like it was within the realm of possibility.
No, there's a very short list. I spoke to Paul Watson, who is the only other Canadian I'm aware of having ever won a Pulitzer.
Oh,
there may be others somewhere in history. You're in like a bunch of very short lists.
Great. Amazing. I feel like because it was such a personal story, because it was like this podcast about my family and my dad, you know, it's taken this long to really be able to look back and kind of take stock of what we did and what we accomplished with that podcast beyond awards and just in terms of the story that we told.
Well, the story itself is such heavy material and it's such personal material. And when you're immersed in something for that long, I don't know. I just imagine that so many of the feelings around it, even when the show is a critical success and a rating success, it's just hard to feel anything celebratory.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, warranted. These are the dynamics in telling these stories, is that we are trying to have successes and tell them in ways that we can feel proud of our work. But, like, it's pretty hard to celebrate. I mean, talking about the story itself, and maybe we'll start with Surviving St. Michael's. Like,
sure.
You brought one of the most painful and electric and awkward and difficult moments in memory in podcasting in the moment when you confront this old man who almost certainly abused your own father and many other members of your family. And it's the end of an investigation, or it's the goal of the investigation to finally have some accountability and put these questions to this person.
This whole thing started because my brother Hal shared that post about my dad and about my dad beating up a priest that had abused him in residential school. We've talked to so many people and heard about so many priests. But he was the first one that we heard about who was abusive to kids. And I don't know. I want to go and ask him, and I want to ask him about the allegations that he abused my dad's brothers, Ivan and Harris. So all we can do is go and ask.
When you finally are face-to-face with a perpetrator, it's a vulnerable, addled, old man. And the moment is requiring you to show a generosity and a kindness that he never showed to the children in his care. There's so much going on in that moment. And you as a journalist, but also as the daughter of a victim.
What about sexual abuse?
No, this I never had.
Because my Uncle Harris said that you sexually abused him.
Who, this one?
Yes.
What did I do? I don't recall that.
He says he was sexually abused by you.
I don't remember that.
And my dad's other brother, Ivan, said you sexually abused him as well.
Well, this was not my style. I don't understand it. It was not my style to abuse kids sexually.
It wasn't your style?
It was not in my way of life.
Well, why would they accuse you if you didn't hurt them?
I don't know if they were. I never heard anywhere I was accused about it. That's the first time I hear about it.
Can you just talk about what that required of you and what that was like to try to navigate that moment?
Yeah, I mean, that was awful. It was terrible. It was like a horrible experience. But I think that, like, it's you're not feeling anything in the moment because you just have to be there and you're doing it. Maybe people get used to doing those kinds of interviews, but I certainly never have. And I think that there had to be a disconnect between the really deeply personal questions I was asking him about my family members that he was accused of abusing when they were children at St. Michael's. And how I felt in that moment, because like I just couldn't kind of be both people in sitting across from him. You know, I had to really feel like I kind of detached and just was there to ask the questions.
Yeah.
And then I think once you're there, you know, you just kind of have to, you just have to do it. You know, I just feel like it was a long time after that I even wanted to like revisit that conversation in any way. It was like we weren't sure if we were going to include it in the podcast for a long time. And then when I did eventually listen to it again, like it was like listening to it for the first time as somebody who had never heard those words before, because it was just such a surreal thing in the moment.
Did you ever witness other people abusing children?
Maybe one time I saw that, but...
What did you see?
What abuse is all about.
What is it?
Sexually, mostly.
Did you see someone sexually abusing a child?
Yes, of course.
Who did you see? Who was it?
Well, I cannot name, because I don't want to put them down.
Well, why not?
Because it's not my style to put people down.
What about the children who were hurt?
Yeah, well, then I can speak to them, yes, and then be sorry about it.
I think that, like, when I heard the story of my father being abused by a priest, you know, I felt so many things in that moment, like, just obviously, like, pain and heartbreak for what he went through as a kid, but also, like, this understanding. I was like, oh, this makes sense in some ways in terms of what I experienced and what he experienced in his life. And I was interested in learning more, like, because even though it was difficult, there was some relief for understanding, or the understanding that came with it brought some relief. And I feel like every step, including like going to interview Gilles Gauthier, the priest, was like another step of that understanding. And so ultimately, like, I can look back on it and feel like glad that it happened, but also still not sure, like, what to take from it besides anger, you know, really, honestly. I'm just left with this feeling of anger and frustration that it's taken this long, mm-hmm. that it's like it had to be an interview when he was 89 years old. Like, you know, why wasn't he ever at, like, he clearly didn't mind the spotlight. He clearly didn't mind talking to journalists. We found interviews where he bragged about his time at St. Michael's, bragged about his work as a priest. And as far as we know, like, he was never held accountable for any of the credible allegations against him.
Can you talk about the actual investigative process that led? And I feel like that was so crucial for that moment. You know, when I was learning how to make radio at CBC, I was taught about, like, light and heat. That moment had so much heat, but the light, that the facts as to what we can solidly say, you and your team did get records.
Yeah, the interview happened before we got records or confirmation from the Oblates that he was credibly accused of abusing kids while he was working in residential schools and adjacent to residential schools.
Can we get geeky and just talk about, like, the actual process? Because at first, sure. the Oblates were completely stonewalling.
I think when we first reached out to them about Gilles Gauthier specifically, we heard from Ken Thorson, Father Ken Thorson, who's the head of the Oblates in Canada. And he, you know, expressed concern and condolences about my father and his experience. And when we had asked specifically about Gilles Gauthier, he said that, you know, he was unaware of any allegations made against him. And when we followed up and sent another email, I remember he said, you know, he's asked around to other Oblates, and nobody has heard of any allegations against Gauthier. And then when we found one of the pre-settlement lawsuits where he was named as the abuser of my dad's brother, my Uncle Ivan, and the lawsuit detailed, you know, it was just in incredible detail, the kind of abuse and the scope of the abuse and how long it went on. It's really devastating, honestly, to read that. We shared that with Father Ken Thorson. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote back and said, upon review of our files, we found 14 allegations, I believe it was, of credible abuse allegations against Gilles Gauthier.
This is a common thing in investigations. First, so we're not aware of anything. And then you independently find the evidence. And then all of a sudden, he magically discovers these other allegations.
Yeah. What's important for me to also point out is that, you know, we heard about him specifically, that specific priest, in one of the very first interviews that we did with my family members. Like, he was known in our family to have abused my uncle. Mm-hmm. And then we started, you know, once we realized that this story was bigger than my dad, this was bigger than even my family, that there were hundreds and hundreds of kids who went to St. Michael's over 100 years. And all of, you know, they're still alive and living in our communities and surrounding communities, and their children are, and the intergenerational survivors are. We were like, this, you know, we want to understand as much as we can about this school. And so we started trying to talk to other survivors. And we heard more allegations just in those interviews against this one priest. And we wanted to be able to name as many people as we could who'd been credibly accused of abusing kids at St. Michael's. And that was like a really difficult thing, because it's like reporting on historical allegations of abuse is really difficult. Reporting on allegations against children is really difficult. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, so much is still unknown about residential schools and about the abuse that occurred there. Like, I feel like we have an understanding of like the big picture, but in terms of like specific schools and specific people who were at these schools in positions of power with access to vulnerable children, like, we don't know their names. We don't really know their names. They like, there have been very few investigations into abuse at residential school, very few convictions. And most of what has been told through the TRC and the settlement process is hidden, is not public information. And so it was really important for us to expose as much of it as we could.
They were going to destroy these records.
Well, they are destroying them. They are going to destroy the IAP records.
Can you explain what the IAP is?
Yeah, the IAP is the independent assessment process, which is what they called the process where survivors received compensation through the Indian Residential School Settlement. So it was usually a series of hearings where survivors would come and there would be an adjudicator and they would tell their story and explain in detail, like excruciating detail, about the abuse they experienced in residential schools.
So these records would be of high interest to you in trying to figure out what the heck actually happened, but not available to you.
They're all completely private and sealed, and they're going to be destroyed in 4 years.
That seems unconscionable.
That's something that not enough people know or understand, that the most comprehensive documentation of what survivors experienced in residential schools across the country is all in the IAP records, and we're losing it. We're going to lose that history. All of the IAP records are all going to be lost unless survivors come forward and ask for their records to be kept.
One at a time. Like, each record has to be requested by the survivor that record pertains to. The records are sealed. To geek out for a minute, how did you learn all this and how did you get access to what you were able to get access to?
Well, we've never been able to access the IAP records.
They're still sealed. But you went around.
Well, we didn't go around, but our producer and reporter Chantal Bell-Richard had the idea that, you know, the only reason there was a settlement process to begin with was because survivors in the 80s and 90s and in the 2000s started coming forward and individually filing lawsuits against the churches and against the government for what they went through in these schools. And she said, what if we try to find those lawsuits? They're all public record. Mm-hmm. And so she filed an ATIP and was able to get a list of lawsuits that pertain to St. Michael's. And so we visited courthouses across the prairies, like Regina, Saskatoon, Edmonton, Prince Albert, and viewed those files. And that's how we were able to find my uncle's lawsuit against the Oblates and the government of Canada, alleging abuse by Gilles Gauthier, and also hundreds of other lawsuits of survivors of St. Michael's.
482 civil lawsuits, 20,000 pages of documents, spanning 80 years, accusations against 15 staff members, 13 nuns, and 17 priests, accused of sexually abusing students, and the result is the most comprehensive documentation of what happened within a residential school. To me, there's a narrative arc to that investigation where I start with these kind of nagging questions of like, is this really like, I get your personal connection to this, but there's like, I'm uncomfortable. Are you settling scores? And like, if there's any doubt about this guy, is this really fair? And then through the course of following that personal thread, What emerges is not just answers about what happened to your family, but the most comprehensive journalistic document of what happened in an institution to hundreds of people. That's so interesting to me, and it challenges certain notions about should we be telling stories that we're too close to, and who's the right person to tell stories. Like it seemed that without that personal connection, none of this would have been revealed.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily have been revealed, but it would have been a different story. And it wouldn't – it's a much better story. It's a much better journalistic investigation because we're transparent about my life and my connections.
We hear you wrestling with these things.
Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, I think like this idea of objectivity in journalism just feels so dated and frustrating because I feel like it's been weaponized against Indigenous journalists and other journalists mm-hmm. of color, that we are seen as advocates if we are telling stories from our own community in the general sense, not even specific community or family stories. And I have certainly felt that like throughout my career that I've had to kind of push back against this idea that I'm somehow an advocate or an activist instead of a journalist. And it was so important, I think, like with Surviving St. Michael's, that this was an investigation, that this was like our journey of trying to expose as much of the truth as we could about this one single school. And yeah, one of the most comprehensive. But that to me is so infuriating that it's 2023, but at the time, 2022, when we were doing this, and this school had been closed since 1997, like, and it's only coming out now. Like, how many stories have we already lost? This is one of over 100 schools across the country. Like, we should be doing this for every single school. This should be happening everywhere. We think we have this understanding of what happened in residential schools, or we think we have this understanding of, like, we know what we need to know, and now we have to get to reconciliation, but we don't, actually. Like, this is proof that we don't actually know everything.
This is something that has played out in a lot of different historical atrocities and how we deal with them. And, you know, I think that how the Holocaust was processed became the template for a lot of things that followed. It was so important to have the records. There are people who say, why are we dwelling? Like, we all agree that this is horrible, what happened. Do you really need to dig up the name of some decrepit old person? And I think that what journalism says is we absolutely do. That's a hard idea to get across to people. I think there is a public perception of, like, why are we endlessly reliving and dwelling on this and picking on individuals? Like, everybody, we've apologized.
Like, name an individual who's been picked on when it comes to resident. Like, have there been people who, like, have individually been held to account? I mean, if you know them.
I think that this truth and reconciliation process differs from historical ones of the past in that that hasn't happened, and that level of accountability. I mean, even formally, it was not a part of the Canadian process.
I mean, I think that, like, it all has to be looked at in the context of Canada, in the context of Canadian history, in the context of, like this one part of Canadian history and how it's actively been suppressed in terms of, like, the knowledge and information about residential schools, but how that fits into the bigger story about Canadian history and the other stories that we don't know or we don't understand. And I think, I mean, when I was at an event, I think it was something The Current did a couple years ago in Ottawa, and Justice Murray Sinclair was there, and he was asked that on a panel. People said, why can't you just get over it? Like, people say that. And he said, you don't say that to Holocaust survivors. Why can't you get over it? You know, I say, why is it so hard for you to remember it? Why is it so hard for you to know it? And I think that's the question. If people feel uncomfortable about, like, oh, we've apologized, and oh, we know, we understand, like, why is it difficult for Canadians to think about it? Like, well, you know,
why do you think?
I think it has to do with this larger erasure of Indigenous history, of Indigenous people, of like the impacts of not just residential schools, but colonization in Canada, and how residential schools was a tool for that in Canada, in Saskatchewan, like very close to St. Michael's. You know, there's bigger histories, there's bigger stories that this is connected to that Canadians don't know and should learn about if they don't know. But what's underlying all of that is the racism that still exists and is so prevalent against Indigenous people in Canadian society. Mm-hmm. That is something that colors every story that needs to be kind of like dismantled before you can create connections and understanding. And that's something that, you know, I feel like with podcasting, like, in terms of a medium, like, we have this unique opportunity to kind of break down some of those stereotypes that exist, some of the barriers to understanding and connection.
You've worked in pretty much every journalistic medium. Your voice as a podcaster evolves from like a straight news reporter, which mm-hmm. is what you were, to one that feels like literary nonfiction, where the process side of the journalism is there with internal conversation you're having with yourself about these things and trying to find a voice as a journalist that is inclusive of family history, of your internal moral struggles. Like it feels like you've found in this medium a way to kind of reflect all of it.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big revelation when we did our first podcast, for me personally, was, you know, I had come from working in mostly TV news, like radio and digital at CBC. And back then, I think it was 2016, 2017, like everything was just getting smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of the kinds of stories you could tell and how many seconds and minutes you had. And I think that especially when it comes to stories about Indigenous people and Indigenous communities, because of the stereotypes, because of the racism, like you really need time and space to connect the dots. Nobody wants to be force-fed like some history that they're not interested in. And I think with the first series, we were able to tell another story, to tell an engaging narrative story about a woman, Alberta Williams, and the mystery surrounding her unsolved murder on the Highway of Tears.
You hear about journalists getting tips from whistleblowers or anonymous sources, brown paper envelopes filled with secret documents. But the tip that sparked this story just showed up in my email one day. The subject said, Alberta Williams murder. Intrigued, I clicked it open. All it said was, she was murdered by... The identity of the person named in that email was just as shocking as the identity of the person who sent it.
And I think through the time that we had through that podcast of like getting to know Alberta's sister Claudia and spending significant time with her and the family and really diving as deeply as we could into their lives, even though this, you know, that happened in 1989 to Alberta, we were able to create space for people to have empathy. Like that's what it boils down to, I think, because it's really hard to do that in even like 8 minutes on The Current or 10 mm-hmm. minutes on The National. Like it's very difficult to kind of have that space. And podcasting, it's wild to me still that people will like put on headphones and listen to a single story over 8 episodes. And
yeah.
Like, hours? Like, it's wild.
It's the f***ing best.
I know.
It's just the opposite of everything else. Everything getting shorter, everything getting dumber. And then, like, just the way in which, especially when you're dealing with traumatized communities, like, by the fourth headline, you're like, you know. But then you've got this medium where you hear a human voice.
Mm-hmm.
And each person gets to be a human. And, yeah, a listener will spend 10 hours with a story that they might not have read 4 paragraphs of.
Yeah.
Your work reminds me of what I love about our medium. And yet, CBC did not renew your series. Like, you get into podcasting, you do the first series. It's sort of like a side project. Millions of people listen to it. I heard that there was, like, a question of, like, is there going to be another? Well, of course, there's got to be another one. And then your second season comes out.
This is a very strange and frustrating story. To have your family member stolen, murdered, then missing.
What is the big secret? Yeah. But to not know anything, not be told anything, and then this child just disappear into thin air now. Something's amok.
My sister Cleo was 11 years old and remembered where she lived and who loved her. She tried to hitchhike back to Little Pine, back home to the reserve, but was picked up, raped, and murdered, and left by the side of the road.
What do you do when complete strangers come and grab you, throw in a car?
And was it 17 million downloads?
I don't even remember, honestly, at this point. But yeah, like it had huge impact.
There's only 40 million people in this country.
I think our audience was mostly in the U.S., honestly. Like we really tapped into.
Well, CBC cares about that. Yeah. And this was a blockbuster. It contradicts everything that, you know, well, we'll do these stories now and then because they're good to do, but nobody really cares about. Like it just completely destroyed that. And people are having that level of depth of a connection with you and with the story. And